Hey guys, welcome to Hope at Health. Today's guest is Stephen Scalle. Stephen is an expert in the field of research with over 25 years of experience. He was previously head of economics and research at the Emirates National Oil Company and deputy director of economic affairs at the Executive Affairs Authority before transitioning to his current role as a scientific advisor in the global sector at Trends Research and Advisory, an independent research institution here in Abu Dhabi that aims to contribute to the shaping of the future. During this episode, we discuss how think tanks carry out research, what are the qualities of a good researcher, the different types of research, and the challenge of managing internal biases in research. And the last message he wanted to share is to connect with more people and do things that make you more optimistic. Please join me in welcoming to the show Mr. Stephen Scalle.
Thank you for that warm welcome. but the first thing I'd like to clarify, I'm not a doctor. Embarrassingly,
okay. That's what I heard the guy saying. I want to be respectful in how you address someone.
No, that's just, I have to correct that. You know, this is on record, right? Normally, I kind of...
You let it. fair enough.
It's just, maybe an emeritus type thing. I've been around a long time and they say, well, let's call this guy a doctor, make him happy. But I'm not a doctor.
Now, okay. Either way, Stephen, then. Let's call you Stephen. Stephen, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Khaled.
So, Stephen, me and you, it's funny, the guests I have on the show, there's the something that probably my audience has heard a lot of times, like, we connected through LinkedIn, and that's usually how things happen. It's rare that I have guests through the people that I've met through, like, the work I'm doing and so on. And me and you met quite a few weeks back at, Trends. And I felt like we really hit it off. You seemed like a very interesting person. The conversations that we were having were quite broad and abject and talking about, culture and this and that. And it was just really interesting. And these are the kind of conversations I like to have. I appreciate someone who seems to share that same level of like curiosity and like knowledge that like I would like to as well. If I understand correctly, you're a senior researcher. That's your primary role. And what I wanted to focus on today is to dive into just the field of research. It's a topic that I've never touched on before. And as I was preparing the questions, there was so many things. I'm like, I'd love to know about that. And how does this apply here? So having someone who's an expert like you on the show would really, I think, shed a new perspective on the field of research and research in general. But before we get into everything, Stephen, why don't you give all of us a little bit of background about yourself and we'll take it from there.
Sure. Well, Khaled, it was indeed a pleasure meeting you last time. And, one part of my background that we didn't get round to, covering in on that occasion is that, like you, I've been around a long time in the Middle East. Okay, so that's why I was asking you these interesting questions, because I knew the questions. I've been down that road myself.
Sure.
So I've been here almost 20 years. I think it's going to be 20 years.
Wow.
Sometime this year. I was originally working in Vienna, prior to that in Geneva at the World Trade Organization, then in Vienna at the UN. And I was hired. I got a call from Abu Dhabi, interestingly enough, to join a research center associated with the it was kind of quasi-governmental at that time. And so I was more than happy to leave the freezing Vienna winter. It gets really cold.
I can imagine.
When the wind turns from it blows from Siberia, and you have to get dressed up with thermal underwear, just to go to the office. Yeah. Terrible. So I was more than happy to accept that offer to come to Abu Dhabi. So then, since then, it's been research, and just to qualify the kind of research we do, it's think tank research. It's not formally part of the academy, so not a university. It's not part of industry per se, and it's a think tank, right? I've always worked in think tanks, which is very, we'll get to that in a minute. It's kind of specific in terms of the research. So I did that for a number of years, again in Abu Dhabi, and then I moved to another place to actually implement policy for some years, energy projects across the board in energy, very interesting times. After which I moved to Dubai to work again for the governmental authorities at the Emirates National Oil Company as the head of economics. So that was,
It
was a corporate job.
Yeah, yeah.
But also research, you know, different kind of research, market forecasts.
Interesting.
The forecasts were never right, you know.
Who would predict oil would bounce the way it has?
Oh, it's very hard. I mean, yeah. You know, predicting oil prices and refined fuels prices, gas prices, it's really hard, although we had pretty much the best resources available, the among the best in the world, but we still never nailed it, or maybe we did once or twice. And you spent a lot of time explaining to your boss, the CFO, well, you know, this is the forecast. Well, why is it? Well, you know, it's complicated.
Yeah. So,
but it was great. I mean, you know, knowing developed a lot of in-depth knowledge about the energy sector. So after that, it was, you know, Abu Dhabi called again my old friends from whom I've known for many, many years to join the Trends Research think tank. And I've been there for the past year and a half.
Okay. So first of all, starting, I wanted to get into something that you touched on that I didn't even know that there was a difference. So you said you've been working more in think tank research.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that there's a difference between, for example, industry research, think tank research, and let's say academic research at a university. In my mind, research is research. It's just you do it in different places, but it's the same thing. So
yeah.
Clearly there's a difference. And is the difference, so could you tell us, first of all, a little bit more about those differences? And is the core of those differences the objectives of those institutions in terms of the research they're trying to do?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's quite insightful. The difference is driven by the different objectives according to the kind of institution.
Okay.
The, you know, if you think about academia, the research is, you know, academics are great at establishing the theoretical frameworks that we all use, and we're in great debt to them, because in any discipline, in any field, they have established, you know, the theory part of it, right? Industry is a bit different, because industry has normally very well-funded research, but also with an agenda.
Mm.
This is absolutely obvious in all kinds of reasons, not a judgment, but it just happens that way. So industry research is different. Over the past 10 to 15 years, by the way, it's become very, very good because of the ability of industry to manipulate and analyze large data sets, in part because of their, you know, the resources, the skills they have, the data scientists, the ability to collate information and all that. But industry research has become you know, really strong over the past 10 to 15 years, and quick. You know, academic research takes months. It's published in a peer-reviewed journal, so that's a process in itself. You have to give it out to 20 peers, 20 colleagues, take some time to get them back, then you have to revise the text and all that, you know, then the publication in the journal takes forever. Whereas industry research is quick. Now, coming to us, think tanks, we're indebted to the academy for their great theoretical work, and we read journals, of course. We don't publish in journals as such unless we really have a few months to do that. You know, we could, we've been asked. And also to industry for the data side of things. But the main difference, I think, is that in think tanks, you know, a few things characterize our efforts. One is that we're very future-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
A good think tank should be 6 to 18 months ahead of things that are public knowledge in terms of the research.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, but sure, it doesn't always happen.
But that's interesting that's the, yeah, like, in terms of you want to be a year to a year and a half ahead in terms of the research you guys are doing.
Okay. And also the stuff that you read in the papers, of course, things like that. That's
gotcha.
Not sophisticated. The second thing is that our perspective is, we strive for a 360-degree perspective. It isn't narrow. Okay, so on... we were talking about advanced technologies a few days ago on, you know, AI, right? The person who is involved in the process of setting up an institution or discussions among governments to regulate AI will, of course, say, look, AI needs to be regulated because I'm going to be the guy doing it. In the industry, it's a bit confusing. I mean, some practitioners and experts say, well, you know, it's the threat is overestimated. Others say, no, we, you know, you must regulate it, and you know they start issuing these very dramatic letters, and Elon Musk signed by everybody to take action. So again, it isn't clear what it's clear what the position is. It isn't clear what's driving it. Sometimes you know there's an interest, and sometimes so on and on. In a think tank, we try to blend those perspectives. We have the academic perspective, we have the practitioner perspective, and we absolutely must provide a view that is comprehensive and complete and objective. You know, there are always, it's always a balanced analysis. You know, these are the benefits, these are the cons. We have various tools to do that. So that, I think, is probably the main difference in perspective. We if our work is worth anything, it must be objective.
Objective.
Yeah. The metric is not whether it's published in a journal, whether it's reviewed successfully, whether it's you know funded by industry or what. The metric is it does it provide you know objective advice and a good realistic insight which is also implementable, because a lot of our research in practice is implemented. So those are the main differences between the three major sources of research. Worth mentioning, media analysis has also become pretty good. I hesitate, well, not in all cases. You looked at me.
No, but I'm just curious. But yeah. When you say media analysis, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so, you know, the media, the big media corporations have allocated substantial resources and efforts and expertise into greater analysis. And if you read a piece by CNN or by you know some of the British press, not all of it, but some of it, or some of the great press in the Middle East, on a particular issue, and it's an in-depth analysis, it's not bad. We read that as well. We don't reference it or use data or anything like that, but on an insight level, that you know they have talent. So, media would be one of the additional sources of knowledge. Of course, the thing is the standards are different in academia.
You know, there you go.
You have a scientific standard, same one that we use. We use the same conventions. So that is a process, and it produces work which is, you know, hopefully, you know, of high quality and defensible.
Yeah. So first of all, first time I've ever heard that there's different types of research, and depending on the industry or the vertical, comes with its own pros and cons. So if I've understood correctly, academia is quite theoretical, very thorough, and it takes has to go through significant revisions for it to be published in a peer-reviewed journal, for it to be considered as legitimate, you know, research. Then you have industry, which you touched on, and when you were saying industry, and in terms of the speed and strength of it, which I probably agree now compared to more than ever. But when I think of that, the first thing that's going to my head, and you said the key word there, agenda, I'm thinking of pharmaceutical companies and the medical field. And I've worked in that field for a year. So, in sales. So I've seen under the hood a little bit on how, you know, and you see and you hear in the news, the fines and stuff, and how much. And you said another key word there, which was manipulating the data. I know you didn't mean it in that way, but you can probably list hundreds of cases of how data is manipulated for profit and maybe to get that medicine passed, to get that FDA approval, to get whatever that might be. And then come the think tanks, and you guys have to take the theoretical perspective. You have to take the actionable perspective or research that these guys have done, marry them. And not only marry them, but also evaluate them on the theory and on the points and if it's implementable and being objective. So on the objectivity part, I believe we are all human beings. We all have our own internal biases. There's research that we might, even the data might tell us something, but I still don't believe that that's, you know, like that's, it doesn't fit my mindset or my belief. So the question then becomes, I know it's impossible to be 100% objective, but then how do we manage or care for those different biases and those different, our own internal biases when it comes to actually producing that research and that data?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a great question. It's the question.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's the question. The, you know, there are, you know, leaving aside the kind of scientific stroke, medical type experimental based research, when there's a control, and so there are kind of objective ways of doing that, which can still be influenced
sure.
right, with the samples and so on.
Sure.
But leaving that aside, the, you know, what, just to characterize it generally, what we find very effective is the exchange among researchers and intellectuals and external experts. So you have to, you know, put yourself in the conditions to have a real discussion once there's a draft, and it's kind of an informal peer review, premised on, in any case, a collegial and academic spirit, a spirit of wanting the best possible product. And also being open to challenge and criticism and hearing other views. I mean, it's really a must. I find that the very good researchers are open to that because it enhances the final integrity of the product, which is, of course, what everybody wants. It's difficult, though. It's difficult. But if there are many voices which are in alignment, even people with different intellectual positions to yours, normally different orientations, then that's a very strong indicator that it's good, it's comprehensive, and it makes sense and is defensible, implementable. If you present it to a policymaker for implementation, it can be successfully implemented because it has integrity, and it has integrity because it's been widely consulted you know, sometimes picked apart, put back together, but it has that strength to endure over time.
Okay. And it has, so if I've understood correctly, it has to, whether challenged, whether for or against, it has to be challenged or dissected enough by different groups of researchers globally to come to a consensus, whether it's for or against, and depending where most of the similarities are in terms of, seems that, let's say 70% are pro, 30% are against, then that gives your research a good standing for it to be considered, you know, legitimate, unbiased, and as objective as possible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is because I've been listening to a couple of podcasts recently, and there's a guy called Graham Hancock. I don't know if you're familiar with him. So he's a British journalist, but he's an ex. His mission is to uncover the history of human civilization.
Wow.
And there's actually a show on Netflix called Ancient Apocalypse. And he takes you around the world, visits all these different places, speaks to all these experts. And what's interesting is what he talks about is, and how it fits into the field of research, he's like, archaeologists all say that there could have never possibly been humans, let's say, in this place before 1500 BC or whatever the number is.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'll go to those places and speak to experts, especially when it comes to like the pyramids and in different places in the world. And, you know, based on history, based on, you know, where was the planet like in the Ice Age, based on so many different factors, it's impossible that the archaeologists are all right based, because this information disproves that no, they're actually here 3,000 years before when they say they are. So, and that's what I'm talking about when it comes to biases. His perspective is, I'm sure the archaeologists would say the same way otherwise, is if they are forced to accept this, it will completely rip apart the foundations of themselves the and the discipline and as archaeologists. And so that's why when it came to the objectivity question I wanted to ask you, I was thinking about that and how there can be so much new potential information that disproves what we collectively believe as this piece of research. And if there's too much resistance, then what if the other side is right? How do you then what happens?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I find interesting, because what you said, you should be open to be challenged and to be, you know, criticized and stuff, because that's your field, that's your job. So when you don't do that, and when you accept that no, it's impossible, it couldn't be, and you believe this data is not correct, it kind of creates that line that we're never going to get to a new phase if we don't actually take a look and actually see what's going on here.
Yeah. I mean, this is the problem of very static fields. You know, I wasn't aware about archaeology in particular, but you know, there are many fields. I mean, I guess two arguments. One is the individual, right? The individual, and in my experience, you know, ego is the enemy here. Typically, you know, someone who has a special experience in, you know, I mean, Buddhism is very good with this, to suppress the ego, being very, very highly educated. You know, you see professors, that, you know, that's another way that they just see something for what it is, right? It's very rare. I mean, it's just
very hard.
Hardly
yeah.
anybody. I mean, it's a very, very difficult thing. So that's one thing, you know, the individual feels the challenge. The other thing is, of course, more complicated on a system level. You know, that you have a university, they have their system of we're talking about peer reviews, mm-hmm. right? Peer reviews, and then, you know, then the people who reviewed it, you know, you acknowledge them as well, and, you know, everyone's citations go. It's a system without criticism. It's just the way that they do things. But, of course, because it's a system that is embedded and works and has its own conventions and its own interests, it's, you know, it's going to remain static.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it cannot easily accept external challenges, even if they're right challenges. So, yeah, it's a complicated matter. But, I mean, you can get around it with process. You know, you force a process, a new process. I've done that a few times in my career. It's never been easy.
I can imagine.
Yeah, because there's only so much disruption that you can pass through a system before, you know, you break it, collapses, right? So you have to be careful with the level of disruption, right? You just can't pass too much through a system and still call it the same system. So that's one. And, you know, it takes time. And inevitably, if the reasons are good reasons and it's well thought out, then, you know, over time, people will align with that new vision, new way of doing things. But it's, you know, honestly.
It's always funny how sometimes, you know, you've seen how many people have won Nobel Prizes 50 years after, you know, they published their research and they're no longer with us. And, like, just to show you the time lag it took for, like, everyone to be like, oh, they were right, but that doesn't, I'm gone now. That okay, I got a Nobel Prize, but what does it do for me now? And right. I think that's one of the biggest issues. So when you look at research, do you, because I know there's, research is, I think, the intersection between, you know, like data and like science and information.
Yeah.
But if I asked you, is research a science or is there an art to research?
Well, that's a good one. I would say it's definitely not a science.
Definitely not a science. Okay, I wasn't expecting you to say that.
Well, but we've just had a conversation about how pervasive bias is,
mm-hmm.
right? So, in you know, research is conducted by people, right? I mean, outside of the mathematical sciences, physics, that is a different situation, because you can, you know, bias is obvious. You know, the results are binary. It's obvious. But research, I mean, we were talking about how medical research, you know, we read has been manipulated, and then there have been fines and then investigations, all kinds of stuff, and it kind of happens all the time. So I wouldn't categorize it as a science, because a science is something very lofty. You know, science is something very objective, very pure. Research, you know, I also said we use the scientific method.
That's why yeah. I thought, I'm like, does it fall under science or research if I'm using the scientific method?
And we do. But you know, it isn't the whole story. When you have research models,
okay,
we're also talking about forecasting. There's a model for forecasts, right? The model, the way a model works is that there are inputs and there are, to make it simple, assumptions. Okay, so there are, in any model will have 10 or 15 assumptions, some of them more. So you can I've done this myself, I mean, you can, pick my words wisely, play around with assumptions, right? I mean, you know, within the normal thing, your assumption for inflation, for example, your assumption for trade, doesn't matter what it is. And there's a range in which you can move this assumption. There are also sensitivities to make it a little bit more complex, and those also have a bearing. So you can pretty much make the model say whatever you want within a range, you know, plus or minus 10 or 15%. So, you know, you can't remove the human component from it. And that's econometrics, you know, modeling-based research or investment-type research where you have a financial model. It's difficult to do. I mean, anybody who tells you different is either, you know, naive, maybe very young, maybe haven't led the development of a model or other kinds of research. So, yeah, I would say it's a blend of being a science and an art, and the art, you know, hopefully, you know, has to be used for good purposes by a serious practitioner with a commitment to the discipline, to objectivity, to the results of research actually meaning something true, right? Something real.
Yeah.
But no, I wouldn't call it a science.
Very interesting. Okay, because you like took the words out of my mouth, because in my head I'm like, the scientific method is the most objective way to, you know, either prove or disprove a theory or an assumption or what that is. But like you said, you're 100% right that the human element, like you only, that will get you to a certain point, but then the human's going to come in, and based on that person, that individual or that team, that's what's going to dictate the quality or the, let's say, the beauty of, you know, the quality of research that you're going to be able to produce.
You just to jump in, you used a very important word, the team. An individual working by himself or herself, normally, you know, they might be brilliant, but normally there are problems of perspective. To get perspective, you need a team. You need a team from different, ideally from different sectors with different experiences, and that will make the research better.
Yeah.
In every case.
Yeah. That does make a lot of sense, because you only know your perspective. So unless someone is there to challenge it, or whether they support it or whatever, they just might bring it to you from a different angle to make you see things a little bit differently.
It's a process.
Absolutely. And you said a word that I haven't heard probably since I graduated university, because I never wanted to hear that word again, which was econometrics. That was my last class, and yeah, it just sucked. I hated it.
Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah, it was. They leave it at the end for a reason. You know, you're either gonna sink or swim. But something we haven't, I guess, touched on up to this as of yet is, what's your story? How did you get into the field of, you know, of research and doing the work that you do? Because I feel there's a very, like, you have to be someone like yourself, like someone like you, like, to be in this field. I think just a personality, I don't have the meticulousness and the dedication and the objectivity to be in such a, I feel it's a very systematic field. I don't know, but I feel if people, researchers are typically people who are quite intellectual, quite academic, like to think of, you know, are thinkers. So what's your story? How did you fall into this field? Or is this something you're like, you've just always been passionate about research and that's what you wanted to do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the answer is that I actively pursued becoming a researcher.
Okay, and also, so that's, from day one, that's what you want, like, wanted.
Yeah, there was never any confusion. Yeah, I've done exactly what I wanted to do.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But, you know, again, I have to qualify my answer. It's, I've always wanted to, you know, first of all, work in the Middle East, which I'm here, and also because, and to be involved in policy-type research, right? And that's mostly what think tanks do. We've been talking about implementing research and actionable research and so on and on. So that's it. Because my personality type is gratified by things that, you know, we see implemented. right? That's why I'm not in academia. Not to say that I'll never be in academia, because there is a trend of practitioner academics. So that, you know, that could be in the cards in the future. But, you know, a certain type of person loves to see ideas implemented, right? It's, I think, as simple as that. Now, it doesn't happen very often, by the way. I mean, we write a lot of position papers, policy papers, white papers, and all kinds of things that, you know, are not implemented. But every now and then, you see something, right? And there's more or less a direct, you know, there's a direct connection. It, you know, ours is not usually the only voice, but it's among the influential voices. So that's very gratifying from a personal point of view. It's just wonderful to see ideas materialize, right? And I think that's probably it. In terms of the Middle East, I mean, look, I love the Middle East. My family says, you know, I'll never come back to Europe. I will, of course. but I just love it here. I mean, you know, the human warmth, the fact that anything can happen, and it usually does. Mm. You know what I'm talking about. All these situations in flux, which are very interesting. A chance to get involved in new things like this podcast. You know, I'm very grateful for the opportunity. And so that's why geographically I'm here. And in career terms, I do what I do.
Yeah. But that's, I've never met many researchers in my life, but I've never met someone who just has loved it and wanted to do it from day one.
Yeah.
So the fact that you are being able to do the thing that you love is amazing, because not many people get to do that. So happy for you for that.
Yeah, that's quite good.
But what you said is you like seeing ideas implemented, and you mentioned that policy research was something that interested you as well. And I think extrapolating on that is, it must be incredibly gratifying to produce work that is going to actually have real life impact on, you know, policy and change. This is going to affect people's lives and
positive policy and positive change. Hopefully,
yes, that's what we all hope for. But that is a very gratifying, you know, I can imagine that's a very, very gratifying feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great thing.
And but also, I think that must teach you so much about, like, you'd have to become incredibly mentally resilient, because to produce those, let's say, out of, I don't know the percentages, but let's say out of...
It's low.
Let's say out of 10 papers and white papers, and this, one went through.
Not even one.
Is it that? Okay, so and that would be, I would find that quite challenging, you know, to be that mentally resilient. Like, for example, when I was working in sales, you develop a different type of resilience, which is emotional resilience. Mm-hmm. You don't care about anything and anyone anymore, because you've been sweared at like 1,000 times. So, you know, that's it. You just become like, all right, okay, it's fine. But with the work that you're doing and the amount of time and dedication it takes to produce that level of work, it must be also quite disheartening sometimes to be like, maybe sometimes I think you could look back and be like, okay, I can maybe accept that one didn't go through, but that one should have gone through. Like, there was like this, you know what I mean? I'm sure you've had those experiences, like gone through these experiences.
Yeah. I mean, no, I certainly have done that, you know, quite a lot over the years. It's the first time I think about it, but, you know, if you look at the career of a researcher, I think there is a shelf life to staying in one place and doing one thing, and the what you just said might explain it, right? I mean, we like to be successful as people.
Sure.
So back when I first started in Abu Dhabi in 2003, at that research center, I stayed for, I think it was 4 years. After which, the phenomenon that we've been talking about, you know, the relatively low percentage. Although there were about three or four things that I saw implemented based on policy papers in 4 years. So there you go, one a year. Yeah, a couple were quite big, a couple like minor things. But after that, I became involved in actual policy implementation. I joined an organization in Abu Dhabi that was involved in actual policy implementation. We set up organizations, we set up programs, we were funded, we hired people, we did all this stuff. And so maybe I was worn out, you know? Could be, because I did look for a change.
Mm-hmm.
And so after also four or five years of that, then I went back into research.
So research, policy research?
Yeah.
Okay.
And now research, the corporate world, right? Which is kind of a mix of the two things.
Mm-hmm.
It's corporate research. And now again, research, think tank research. So maybe, but you know, I mean, it's also the intellectual gratification.
Sure.
It's not just the success part of things. It's great to write a great paper, to discuss it with a strong team, to take their ideas on board, or you know, explain why you're not doing that. It's very, even that part of the process is interesting.
Mm.
You know, but of course, inevitably, it's nice to see ideas become reality as well.
Yeah, you need a win. It's nice to have a win every once in a while.
Of course.
But I think you made such an important point, which is, you're like, even in the process, whether the, yes, obviously I want it to be successful, but that process of writing that paper or building that, it's all about you're 24/7 learning. Mm-hmm. And that, for me, personally, I love to learn. It doesn't matter about what, if I, any little thing I can learn about something, it's the for me, the most satisfying feeling even, and the best place, or like my hardest place,
yeah.
The most brutal place that I learned is right back here in the kitchen, because that's the place I learned the most.
It really is.
Yeah. But as an just mirroring it as an example, like, yeah, I've made thousands of dishes that were absolutely terrible, and I just ate it because I'm like, I worked 3 hours for this. It's bad, but I'm not that. Those 3 hours aren't going to waste. But obviously, do I want it to be the best all the time? Sure. But I think, do you believe in order, like, okay, let's talk about this. What would you say if you were hiring someone for a research position now? What are the kind of characteristics that I should have that you would say, you know, those are good, important qualities that every researcher needs to have? I'm sure learning is one, curiosity would be another. What would be those? But those are, I think, easy to come to head. What are some things that maybe I wouldn't see that someone like yourself, with your experience, would be able to be like, okay.
Yeah, we don't always see them, but in principle, there are a couple of things that we look for.
Sure.
In addition to the ones that you just mentioned, it's very important to have a kind of a mission-driven personality, right? That's important because you largely decide your own scope, and in any case, even if you're assigned a scope or a mandate, you know, you have to execute it. So you have to be interested in reaching the end of the mission, right?
Oh, okay.
It's not the same process every day, right? So there's also there are kind of behavioral things, and people need to have a mission-driven personality in a fast-moving research environment like ours. If you're sitting in a university, it could be you can have more of a kind of sedate, programmatic type thing. You know, every day you work 4 or 5 hours, you teach 2 hours. But in a think tank, it's totally different. So that's one thing. The second thing, you know, maybe you'll find this interesting. Do you know why astronauts are so friendly? They select for this, by the way. Astronauts are selected among their most important qualities is the, what do they call it? They have a psychological name for it, but basically they are super friendly. And they're super friendly because if you're in the space shuttle, you're in a landing capsule, whatever it is, and there's a problem and you start arguing and blaming each other and fighting, you know, that is going to lead, it's a known thing that is going to lead to much bigger problems. So you have to be friendly, you have to cooperate.
Mm-mm-mm.
It's critical. I used the word collegial earlier on, so to have a team of collegial researchers and cooperative researchers and friendly researchers is great.
Mm.
It literally is paradise.
Mm-mm.
You know, because the situations never really escalate. We're all supposed to be intellectuals, and so kind of try to keep it level. So that's important as well.
Yeah.
You know, we can't afford it. When you work in teams in general, you know, you have to be, you know, either actually be friendly or be able to fake being friendly and get on with everybody. So that's also important to be able to do that. Then your curiosity, you mentioned, technical ability is always good.
When you when you say technical ability, what in the field of research, what does that translate into? Yeah.
It can either be being extremely good, you know, maths, numbers, at least being numerate. That always helps because of the data analysis. It's very good, of course, to be logical, to have a logical, methodological system, and to use logic all the time. And it's also good to be, as you would imagine, a very good writer, a person who can express themselves in a written form or in a spoken form when they ask you to speak. So those are the three main, I think, technical qualities that we look for. Yeah, it's not rocket science, right? But to be a good researcher, that's probably necessary.
Astronaut thing you mentioned was really, really interesting, but I can imagine it makes, when you listening to you explain it makes sense, especially for them. You are in the harshest environment in the world. You don't really have time to have beef with like another with like another person. You just can't. One thing when it comes to research, which I find interesting, is I look at research like I look at a piece of like a dish or music or literature or writing or philosophy. What do I mean by that is, and I've asked musicians this, I've asked chefs this, I've asked everyone this question because I'm curious about this. It's those fields, and everyone tells me the same thing, but maybe research is the one field that's a little bit different. When it comes to like a musician I've had on the show, I'm like, how do you know when a song is finished? And I'm like, and they always tell you that, everyone tells me the same thing, like, okay, yes, you have, there's a foundation that needs to be there, but then it's just, they all tell me it's a feeling. It's just a feeling, and it feels like this is done, because you could come, I could release that album, come in a week, and I'm like, oh my God, like I would have done this and that. And I feel like more than any of those fields, research is like the, like, ultimate playground for that, because every day there's new information coming, every day there's something new. So is it a feeling when it comes to research? Because I feel like it can't just be a feeling,
you know. if you leave it up to feelings, you'll never be done.
You'll never be done.
This is it's almost always an externally imposed thing. You know, your director is saying, I need this policy paper now, like I need it now. Or the publisher saying, I need the manuscript now. Because it's, you know, or you just feel so embarrassed by being so delayed that you would, you know, auto-impose it on yourself to actually finish. You're very sheepish. I wrote this last night, I finally finished and my email draft, it was full of apologies then. Said, right, too many apologies, take some out. But it was still apologetic, and with cause, because it was very late. I guess the others, you look for perfection, right? You look for perfection, but it's a rabbit. If you go down that path, you need to be pragmatic. At some stage, this has to get finished now, right?
Yeah.
Want it, or, you know, you just need to finish it.
So let me now build, so okay, I understand the time pressure is going to be that fire under your ass that's going to be like, all right, even if I don't think it feels like it's done, whatever, I think there could be more, but this is it. July 10, 2023, as of now, this is what it is. But then, so now when you, in your case, because I've asked the same question to the people I just mentioned, reflecting back on previous papers you've done, previous work that you've done, do you ever look back and be like, what the hell was I, how the hell did I write that? What was this, how did I use that outdated process compared to like now what I would do? Or do you look at it as based on that time, that knowledge, that expertise, that maybe technological capability, I can live with that right now. Even if though it's even if I completely think it's wrong now, I'm okay with it right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, that's really the question of philosophy, right?
And that's where I was going next.
How does one assess one's own efforts in, you know, in the light of this, of the available technology, experience, and all that stuff? I myself don't tend to look back too much at all.
Okay.
You know, just, okay. I don't know why, I just don't. Maybe it's a mission-driven thing, you know, it's on to the next thing. I mean, if something, certainly haven't all been amazing reports or papers. I mean, I know that for a fact, forecasts. But then again, you know, yeah, like you said, you do the best that you can do with the knowledge that you have at that time. But something that I did learn, is to actually say this sometimes, right? I had an excellent American boss years ago, and he always said it. That's, you know, I learned it from him. And when he'd make a decision or, you know, submit something, a paper, a report, he'd say, look, absent any new information, we believe this is a correct analysis. Mm. Absent, and he'd always, you know, caveat, absent any new information, right? Or unless it's something I don't know. It was always about information, right? A blind spot. I don't know something, which is very wise when you think about it, right? Absent something new coming up, this is it, right? So you protect yourself,
yeah,
in that way. And so that's smart, right? That comes with experience.
Yeah. And because I'm paraphrasing here, but there's that famous quote, I don't know which philosopher said this, you know, once you think you've learned everything, that's when you know like you've lost or something along those lines, you know.
Sounds a bit like Socrates.
Sounds like one of those guys. And it kind of builds on what you were just saying, you know, in the absence of new information, this is what I believe. We talked about earlier about, we talked about agendas and different industries, different perspectives have different agendas, right? Where does philosophy intersect with research? I know it does. I just don't know how. Is it your personal philosophy that it comes into the research? Because you might have, this is like, this. You might believe exactly like what you just said, but the organization you might be working for might have a different philosophy about research and how it's done and how it has to be produced and so on, and how we have to reflect. So where does philosophy fit into this research field?
Well, I mean, look, leaving, you know, personal philosophies aside of, you know, of excellence, of dedication, the things that we might believe in, the philosophy is essentially the pursuit of truth, essentially, right? So if you look at the mottos of the great universities of the world, they usually have something to do with truth, right? To know the meaning of truth, or just the word truth in Latin, veritas. So that is the purest intellectual philosophy, to pursue the truth. And that's why those great institutions embody that as a value, as a university motto, because that's so critical to any intellectual effort. Even the early theme of this conversation, if it's not objective, it ain't worth anything.
Right? Yeah.
So that's why I think that research centers, you know, the research method, the research process aims to answer the research question. Right? That's why we do research. There's a research question.
Not the truth, necessarily.
Well, the answer, like any answer, ought to be true.
True.
It ought to be the truth, or close to the truth, or open about why it's not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what the ultimate objective should be. Test the hypothesis, and you prove it or disprove it, and you progress the state of knowledge in that discipline towards the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I would answer that. In terms of philosophies, you know, without making it too complicated, but that's...
So when does... I've had journalists on the podcast before, and...
They said the same thing.
They said... yes and no. Yeah. So, because my question to her was, I'm like, okay, a story happens in X country. Khaled and Stephen are both there. We are both reporting on that story, right? We have seen the truth of what has happened. We saw it with our eyes. It doesn't get more truer than that.
Right.
But you're, let's say, from the States. I'm working for a news agency here. The way we tell that story might be completely different. Your agenda of, you know, what you guys do over there might be completely different to mine. So that's what I was telling her, and it kind of touches on what you're talking about. Yes, there's this pursuit for truth. There could be the truth of what we have seen or what we have experienced. But she also told me something, and one or two people have told me that, is that the truth is subjective. So if we're all striving for the objective, purest truth, and yet in our own lives, in our own beliefs, in our own biases, our truths are all subjective. Mm-hmm. So how do we, I can't see a way where these two will ever link. They will intersect, I'm sure, at different points, but there's always going to be that disconnect at some point.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, you know, when we don't want to answer something right or wrong, right? We say that's, but we want to give it a direction. We say that's more true than false, right?
Sure, yeah, I'm giving more weight to that.
Yeah, it's more true than false. What you're saying is, of course, more true than false. The question of bias is always, you know, it's always there. I mean, the way that I look at this is that I prefer to be open about my biases in a work sense. You know, if there's a, I can't go into too much detail here, but if there is a, in the past, for example, like years and years ago, if there was some matter about, not so much defense, but, you know, some kind of a security type situation,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In a policy sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I would just say, well, look, I'm a Westerner. Therefore, my advice is highly likely to be aligned with a Western perspective.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Right? Yeah.
So, you know,
you're calling it out.
Yeah. So you should know that before you assign this to me, because that's what you're going to get.
Yeah.
I'm not going to start inventing something else or start, you know, I'm going to say what I think. And,
respect.
You know, yeah. A lot of our thinking is based on our kind of, you know, values, old kind of stuff that you get from your family, from your, you know, traditions and from your culture and so on. And so that's, So I think in that particular scenario, it was whether, you know, to support a, kind of a Western democracy type arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
Or not. I said, well, of course, I support. I'm a Westerner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would not say that, you know, this is what I grew up with, this is what I believe.
Yeah.
So there's that. And interestingly, I still assigned the project, and I still wrote that, you know, and it went very well.
Yeah, well, there you go.
It wasn't.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's funny. I respect that, and I don't know how much I can talk about this. So, when we recently met, you know what's going on. One thing I told, I was telling the team, I'm like, when it was coming to, you know, selecting the, you know, potential, I was like, listen, I kind of said what you said. I'm like, I can give you my perspective, but my perspective is going to be very biased. Yes, there's certain things I'll be judging on or basing it on, but for example, me and you had a great connection on many different levels. You could bring someone else who's, you know, just as nice, but we don't have that chemistry. Yeah, there's going to be a bias there. So I told him, like, this is what I think, but like, it's not my word's not final, you know, but this is my recommend, based on my experience and what I've seen, this is my recommendation. So I understand. I think calling it out is the most, I don't know what the word is. Honorable? Is that the honorable? Yes. Is that the word I'm looking for?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, I don't know. I'm just trying to be honest about it. Yeah. You know, like
I
facts.
I think so. No, but I mean, you're right, Khaled. The, you know, evidence against interest, right, is very rare. Right. When you say, you know, for example, in the office, you know, there may be someone that you just don't like.
Well, right? Yeah.
There you go. Happens all the time. But every now and then, you know, that person makes a great point. And so I think that, you know, in that situation, to actually say, well, it's a great point. You know, it's the meeting of the minds, of the ideas, forget about the other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's very rare. And that's also a form of, you know, being, you know, super objective and saying exactly, you know, where you stand. No, I don't like this individual. However, what he just said makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a very refined skill.
Yeah. It's obviously hard to do because, you know, emotion and logic, you know, are always fighting each other. One thing I realized is I didn't know you couldn't fight one with the other, just to give you some context. So I did therapy back in 2020. I went to therapy, you know, I had, and I didn't know
it was tough back then, right?
But it wasn't honestly
did it or needed it.
It was on my mind for years. And I think 2020 was just the catalyst for it because I had to figure out, I'm like, what's going on? I believe that we can all fix ourselves, but that doesn't mean, and I was operating on that for a couple of years, but you get to a point, you're like, my perspective is limited. I need someone else to come in and show me something else because I've exhausted all my resources. But what I learned in that experience is I could feel exactly what you said. I could feel a certain way about you, about a person, but logically I understand the pros, I can understand the cons, but that doesn't change how I'm feeling. And I could never understand why. I'm like, I can see both sides. Why do I still feel like this or negative? And my therapist taught me something that really stuck with me. He's like, you're trying to fight emotions with logic and vice versa. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. You're trying to, you know, fix, you know, round peg in a square hole. Like, that's what you're trying to do right now. And it was just very insightful to me to understand that you could be logical and emotional, and you have to approach them in different ways. And when it comes to research, and when we're talking about emotions, we're talking about all these types of things. We've talked about the biases, we've talked about the objectivity. Obviously, we haven't spoken about the bedrock of what research is based on, which is, without this, we can't do research, which is data.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah,
it's the data part of the conversation.
It's the data part, because I don't think we can have a conversation about research without speaking about data. So. Yeah. I don't know when it comes to these things. So how could you share with us, or how do we determine, you know, the quality of like a data or like an article or a paper? And I know those are all different things, but let's just start with the most important, which is data. How do I know that you've not manipulated that data? How can I test that data? What if I don't have the resources to test that data? I might just have to take your word for granted. And the floor is yours.
It's hard. The, you know, data. You know that quote by a British prime minister, goes back away, Benjamin Disraeli. He said there are lies, damned lies, and statistics.
Right. So that's a great quote.
Yeah. So in that.
Order, that's a great quote.
So and yeah, when I say this to our statisticians, they don't like it very much. They just don't like it.
That's fair. That's fair.
Yes. So, look, I mean, it's hard. Even when you do primary research, right? Primary research surveys, for example, okay, we have a survey department.
And that's you, sorry to interrupt you, that's you like physically collecting the data yourself or your organization or you guys are collecting it.
Yeah, but so that's prime, you know, it's your data.
Yeah.
I know that they are wonderful and very experienced survey team have a lot of controls in place to ensure objectivity. and then they do statistical analysis. So, you know, they do a great job, always objective, and you know, you have to clean the data a lot, right? You have to, if answers are just weird in a statistical sense, they're outliers, you need to look into why they're outliers. You might go back to the questionnaire, you might physically want to see it, check the answer, maybe even speak with the person, have a focus group, do something, right? So there are all these controls and processes to ensure that the data is accurate and complete and is not in any way manipulated, right? Either by the people answering or by the other teams involved. So it's the statistical part, this is where statistics comes in, is very important for that, and also the experience. Now, having said all that, you know, I mean, I can vouch for my colleagues because I've known some of them for a very long time. So I can vouch for them. But in general, where primary data is involved, you know, you need lots of controls, processes around the entire data collection effort, then cleaning the data, then the statistical analysis, if it's going to be worth anything. And you need to look at anomalies and explain them or rationalize them and understand them. So it's hard. The you need skill, you need resources, which is why corporations are great at this. International organizations are also increasingly good at this. If you've been to a UN website recently, World Bank, IMF, they're amazing with data. But you know, even they have their scandals, right? The way the data is reported by the countries and by the IP, and then you know they had a problem with some index some time ago, right? There was a some kind of an economic index or ease of doing business index. They cancelled it. They found that some countries had been you know, trying to get around the normal process, whatever that process was, to influence their standing in the index, which is, you know, again, I guess, I hesitate to say understandable, but it's a human instinct, right?
Sure.
So, and that's, you know, the IMF and the World Bank. And they couldn't control it. And there was a scandal, they closed the whole thing, the index. So the answer is, as the answer has been throughout this podcast, it's difficult. You've just got to try to do the best you can, use process, rely on bona fide experts and expertise with, you know, long track records and all that stuff. But yeah, and as you know, if the data's wrong,
then the research is
garbage
useless.
In, garbage out.
Yeah, there you go.
That's why it's so important. That's why you asked the question.
Yeah, that's why. I was curious.
You should have asked it at the beginning.
Yeah, maybe I should have. But on the... so I know in everything we've talked about today, the questions I have, I'm trying to get an objective answer. I know I can't, but I want to hear... Like how close can we get, you know? Or like how far are we, you know? Yeah. Either way, I don't mind. In your career, though, now you've been a researcher for over, you know, 20, 25 years. Could you, I'm sure by now, you probably have built up, because you've been doing it for so long and in different ways and in different formats, you built up a foundation of knowledge and skills that you, could you now, maybe not, again, not perfectly, but if I came and I showed you, I'm like, here, Stephen, here's two different sets of data. Which one do you think is bullshit? Could you look at it now and be like, I can quickly probably discern, like, yeah, I think that one.
Well, maybe not quickly. It takes a while.
That's fine. Okay. remove the quickly part, but you could get to that.
But yeah, I could probably see, I mean, because I've worked a lot with numbers, and so you learn to discern patterns, to understand classifications. If numbers have been cooked, especially if they've been badly cooked, it's obvious.
Really?
Yeah, it's obvious. I've seen that. Yeah, because some person has taken the Excel and like changed the number, and you can detect human interference, right? Because it's unless it's extremely well done, you can see that, you know, everything is like a two, right, or a point. The decimal is more or less the same. You can see that they've tried to maybe change it a bit.
Interesting.
So yeah, I mean, a statistician can do that much better than I can. Because he would look at numbers all the time, statistics all the time. There are also various tools that can be used, and But you know, that's not such a big problem anymore. It used to be, when you don't have traditions of proper, you know, data completeness, accuracy. Of course, people are scared of being found out. Right? Nobody wants to be the person who's it's a horrible thing. You start changing the numbers.
And I feel in your field as a researcher, if you're found out, I think compared to like a CEO maybe who's embezzled money, you might not get hired, whatever. But I think in such an academic-based field, that your work is your credit.
Yeah.
That's your badge. If that badge is removed, nothing you produce again
anything
is going to be...
Anything like that, the data manipulation, plagiarism, anything like that is fatal to your career as a researcher.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we talked about... So I was thinking just now, you know, there's a fit like we famously or typically say... Yeah. But based on our conversation, I think it's an interesting that has come up is I'm like, numbers don't lie. But based on our conversation, there you go. There you go. So is it numbers don't lie, but people do? Or like, what is it? You know, I'm just trying to think.
Well, there are standards and processes are the solution. That's how you get around it.
Yeah,
standards, processes, and the old audit principle to have many people involved. You know, four eyes, six eyes, like that. That will get rid of 90% of the egregious stuff if it's there to begin with. But it's a good practice to to be careful with numbers and data. Course.
Sure. Yeah. So standards and processes are, and I guess the more rigid those are, the more control or the better chance you have of, you know, weeding out the bad data or like the stuff that's not true.
Yeah, I mean, you lose time.
It's not perfect, I'm sure.
You lose time
and
you use resources up, but ultimately, I mean, when you see a really good data set that really says something, and it's a true data set, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, because it's an insight into a brand. So
especially some of the behavior stuff, what people really think in surveys. That's great. It's very insightful, often different to what one imagines they would think.
But yeah.
Like, wow, they really think that. That's incredible.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So that's that's really insightful.
So moving, you touched on it at the beginning of our conversation or before we started recording, and I think this is the perfect time to bring it into the conversation, which is obviously I can't not have a conversation today without talking about this, which is technology and AI. So now, and I remember with that show I told you about earlier, what's cool is now they have like LiDAR and all these technologies that are being able to show them things and understand information that they've never seen before. So obviously as technology advances, it's going to advance, you know, the field and the capabilities of the field of research. And now with AI, for example, you know how we used to say, like, we've been researching, I would say Google has been is everyone's research tool. But now you have, it's like that next level up. And so the capabilities eventually that you're going to have here are going to be even more than here. And the challenge is going to become now, how do you, for example, prompt the AI? What are the inputs you're putting into the AI? Even now there's AIs for plagiarism and so on. So I guess give us, where do you see the what's the positive you see of AI and technology coming in, like being introduced into the research field? And what is something you maybe are a bit like, we should proceed with a little bit of caution at the same time?
Caution, yeah. Well, yeah, it's of course the question of the day, you know, not only in research, but in
everything,
in other areas. The potential, it's a trade-off, right? You know, what are the risks? What are the potential gains? I think, you know, what is clear is that, like all fields that are not mature, there's a lack of sufficiently good information to take a good view one way or the other, right? It's all kind of conjecture. It seems that AI is a very powerful research tool, very, very powerful. My understanding is that there are problems with problems in terms of its effectiveness as a research tool, that it's not up to date, right? So that's the thing. If I get a report that is, you know, ends in 2021, a couple of years ago, and it's a beautiful report, but it has nothing over the last 2 years,
yeah.
I would probably...
no use to me now.
I would probably wonder about that.
You know? Yeah.
How exactly did that happen? But, I mean, clearly it's a powerful tool. The whole governance and regulation, which always happens around very powerful tools and things where there's a big downside, you know, whatever, weapons, sanctions, or anything dangerous gets regulated. You know. That hasn't, you know, we hear governments talking about it, the EU, the US, and some of the companies, but it hasn't, no one's really seen anything. So it's not clear. It's not clear to me what's going to happen. But one trend, which I personally think is going to be quite prominent in the future, is that we will instinctively become more maybe suspicious of the written document, and maybe seek out more opportunity to actually speak or hear people speak, and that type of connection, right, face-to-face connection, I think that will separate the quality, the scholars or the personalities from AI generated scholars or other things like that. I think that this will, there's a bright future, I think, for face-to-face interaction, conferences, and in our field it's pretty obvious, you know, if a conference speaker is good, you know, if he or she is prepared, if they know the field, and they do all that stuff. And if there's a poor speaker accompanied by a great conference paper, I mean, that can have an explanation. Maybe they're just not a good speaker. Who knows, right? But normally in with a panel of experts, and you're asked questions, you have to be on the ball if you're not. So that's, I think, a trend that that we might be seeing more of. What can't you do with AI? Or the creativity side of things. I mean, in your business, right? You can't replicate this with AI. AI will never do this. Well, I think.
Not yet. I've still got a couple of years before.
From your point of view, in your business? Well,
let's say if we're taking it as a podcast, because what's scary is now you've heard, like, there are AI tools that have made songs that sound
paintings, like Drake.
If you never told me, for example, I don't know about the painting example. I know about,
they're good.
They're not only good, but a song. See, you mentioned face to face is that
unthinkable.
Like, yeah. That's it. Yeah. It's never gonna. Well, who knows? Robots and stuff. We don't know. But again, see, it's so hard to predict, because everything, I'm like, no, this is the limit. But I'm like, but also maybe not. I don't know. I would say the authenticity of a human interaction like this, or this kind of conversation, is almost impossible to replicate. And I speak this from experience, because even if we sat down and we pressed pause and we're like, Stephen, let's start from the beginning, it's going to be a completely different conversation. We will not be able to replicate the authenticity, the things we've talked about, the energy. Right, it's not. It's just different. Yeah. Is it impossible? I would say I don't think it's impossible,
but I just can't see it happening.
I don't know. I really don't. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if it didn't get to that stage. But if it did, it also wouldn't surprise me. That is the best way I could describe my perspective.
These days, you know, technology, the step changes, right? That's what, you know, when you have a graph and you have a linear, you know, even an exponential linear improvement, well, okay, that's kind of predictable. But when someone invents something new, you know, and we call that a step change, because there's a step in the graph, right? It's not a line, it's a step. And we have so many step changes these days. For who knows what the next one's going to be?
It's fascinating. Yeah, it really is, and it's even with like my workflow. I use multiple tools now. It's been a game changer for me. Like it so makes my life so much easier. It saves me so much time. But I think we're all just scratching the surface. If it's doing this now, I can't imagine in 5-10 years what the capabilities of these types of platforms are. I have no idea. We talked at the beginning. You mentioned something earlier in the conversation bring everything full circle, which was we talked about the characteristics of a good researcher. And you said they have to be mission driven. So, and the essence of research and philosophy, that our essence is we're trying to find the truth. So I have a mission and I want to find the truth about a specific thing or a specific area or a specific field. So my question then becomes, so what is that for you, Stephen?
Well, it's a deep one. It's a deep one. The mission to find the truth. Well, look, we look a lot at trends. We look a lot at trends, and inevitably, there's a focus on things that we think might be, good or the worst things for society and more broadly even for countries and regions. Something that I am very attracted to personally is the interfaith dialogue.
Interfaith
dialogue, yeah. Okay. So that's actually a thing.
Okay.
It's actually a thing.
Okay.
We don't do that much research on it, but it's one of the things that we look at, one of the program areas.
And could you tell us what that is? I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, interfaith dialogue is dialogue among the three Abrahamic religions.
Okay.
So Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. That's called interfaith dialogue, and it is a really fascinating area. It's really fascinating because it has, literally over the past 5 or 6 years, there's been an Abu Dhabi declaration on this. The Pope came a few years ago in his drove a Skoda or something up to the Emirates Palace. It was spectacular. And then they signed this Abu Dhabi declaration it's called the Declaration on Human Fraternity. And I think that is, when you asked about the truth, it's another way of asking, what do you think is going to be one of the most significant things in the future, right? There are lots of things which are potentially very significant in a bad way, but I'd rather avoid those. It's kind of talk about all this bad stuff, wars, pandemics, AI getting control of and killing everybody. It's just, why would I do that? But I think on the positive side of the ledger, interfaith dialogue really has legs, as a trend, as something, as a truth, of a good thing, right? At the moment, our attention is distracted by the conflict in Russia and Ukraine. For once there isn't a war in the Middle East, it's wonderful. It's a beautiful thing. It's bad that there's a war somewhere else, but at least there isn't one, or active one, in the Middle East. But I do think that interfaith dialogue is something that if it increases in the future, is going to be very positive for societies, religious communities, countries, and individuals. And it's a great thing.
That's real. I've never heard. So when you say
it's a thing,
I've never heard that before. So when you say interfaith dialogue, and it's a trend that's building, is what you mean by that now? People how do I explain this? The increase in the trend, that trend building, when you say interfaith dialogue, is that me and you sitting down and they're like, okay, Stephen, I'm a Muslim, for example, you're a Christian, all right, let's sit down and let's talk about the differences, about this, what you believe, what I believe. Is that what you...
That's it.
Okay.
It's understanding the other two religions.
Gotcha.
Right.
Gotcha.
The other two religions, and the you know, imams do this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scholarly ones, the rabbis, of course, do this.
Yeah.
And also our you know, Christian members of the church at the certain levels are also very interested in this. But it's more than just religious figures. It's more than that. It's really about communities coexisting peacefully, productively, and everybody just having, you know, a wonderful life. You know,
this has
happened in history.
Yeah,
it's happened in history. It has a lot to do, as you can imagine, with tolerance, right?
Yeah,
wherever there's been tolerance historically, in the south of Spain from the 11th until the 13th, 14th centuries, there was a great civilizational momentum. You know, arts, culture, the economy, everything worked well. And when there's been a lack of tolerance, you know, in Europe in the Middle Ages, the horrible things that we did with the Inquisition and all the other bad things that form an unfortunate part of European history, when there's been a lack of tolerance, then that has been a disaster and has ruined the next two or three centuries until things.
It's a seesaw.
It's a
famous saying, you know, history. Yeah. Do you believe that famous saying that history repeats itself?
Is the complete saying history repeats itself for those who don't know history? Is it something along those lines?
I don't know. I just know history, like that, you know, or maybe my phrasing is incomplete.
The history of history shows that it indeed does repeat itself. There's peace, there's war, there's peace, there's war.
We just never learn, do we?
Never.
Never.
The human condition.
that really is the human condition.
Right.
Stephen, I just have two more questions for you. These are questions that I ask all my guests. So first of all, looking back at your career or your life, either personally or professionally, when I ask you the question, what are you most proud of for yourself? What would you say?
In a career sense? Yeah. Okay. So the answer now is different to the answer had you asked me that we met 10, 15, or 20 years ago. Well, 20 years ago, you would have been a kid, so that wouldn't have been.
Yeah, just a little bit.
But the thing that I think makes me happiest, is that the question? Most proud, right? Proud, happy. Has nothing to do with the work. You know, the work, you know, you do something, you get, you know, it's a success or not a success. If it's a success, you're proud and you feel happy. But that's a very superficial thing, in my opinion. And over time, it becomes more superficial. When you're in your 20s, 30s, it's all about that, right? But really, what I remember with a certain pride is when there's been a positive kind of a mentorship or an effect on it's usually a junior colleague. I mean, sometimes a colleague, you know, the same position, same age, but typically, you know, the younger mind is more plastic, you know, can be formed, and so, you know, when you set an example, hopefully it's a good example, and then you see that person, you know, adopt that, and they become a little bit like that, and it's good for them, and it's good for the organization, and you know, the community, whatever, then that's very gratifying. That's a good thing. And it's a clear thing. I can't say it's happened all that much, but a handful of times it has. Yeah? And I'm still in touch with those people, and we have, you know, very, you know, good memories of the time that we worked together, and you know, they remember me apparently with fondness, and so that makes me happy, and I see they're successful in what they're doing, so that's, you know, not of course because of, you know, but you know, the whole thing, right? The whole cake. So I think that's it. Mostly, you know, at the end of the day, it's about connection.
Sure. Right?
At the end of the day, it's about connection. There's a, you know, if you give me a minute, there's something. There was a study reported in the BBC years ago, but it always stuck with me. I always remembered this. Somebody got into their heads to ask people in an old people, in a hospice, literally receiving end-of-life care, right? So they were, it's a terrible thing. They were about to die, and they're being interviewed by researchers. They asked them, what do you regret most? And an amazing percentage said, well, I regret most that, you know, that I didn't connect more.
Mm.
That was their regret. It wasn't, I wish I had made more money, I wish I had worked less. They said, I wish I had connected more. So I think the older you get, the more you...
I 100% echo what you're talking about. And it's funny, who was I speaking to recently? I think me and my wife were sitting the other day, and I was telling her recently I've been having, like, with the work I'm doing, is it feels like, yeah, I'm a consultant and we have a job to do, and yeah, but it feels there is an educational aspect to it. I need to teach you about this world.
Right, I can see that in the office.
But it's a very satisfying feeling.
Yeah.
I love that. A guest I had on a podcast, he's like, Khaled, when you teach someone something, he's like, it's like magic. It's not like something you're giving them. It's through the things you're saying, your mind, you're creating this magical, beautiful connection.
Yeah.
I've
seen this when you were using the whiteboard. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I love. Yeah, I'm a whiteboard guy.
I saw how their minds somehow opened, you know,
and that
towards
that,
the right.
Yeah, that's yeah. And that, because that's my favorite feeling in the world. That's why I do this podcast, and that's why it's not in a particular field. Like, I don't focus just on this or that. I want to speak to everyone about anything, because I have these eureka, open mind moments all the time. So it's like, selfishly, I'm like, yes, again, I love it. But I really resonate with what you're talking about, that feeling of, you know, that you played a part in someone's life and had a positive impact on them, helped change their perspective, change whatever they...
Something.
That's a beautiful feeling, and that's exactly why I do my podcast. That's what I'm trying to do. That's why it's called Hope It Helps. I'm like, if you listen to this, maybe you took something away. Great. If you didn't, also, that's okay too. You know, that's why there's the hope in there. I'm not saying it's definitely going to help, but I hope it does. And Stephen, for my last question, what is the message that you'd like everyone to take home with them today?
Well, this isn't the first time I've been asked this question. I should have said that. I should have just answered the question. But anyway, so my answer then and my answer now is the same. I think that today there's a lack of optimism, right? Generally, which is unsurprising. I mean, you know, pick up any newspaper, any website, and it's just terrible news, horrible, depressing.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
So I think, you know, to avoid that building up, you know, in someone's psychology, it's important to I'll change my message slightly. You know, do things that make you optimistic, right? Not just be optimistic, that's too abstract, but try to do things to make you optimistic, and, you know, maybe connect more with people. That's also, you know, if the BBC was right, and I think they probably were.
Yeah,
you know,
I would say they were.
It is the one thing that is probably going to make us happier. Connect more, become optimistic about things, and hope that helps.
No, there you go. that definitely helps me. So yeah, I work.
Oh, me too.
But what you said something really interesting there, that when you said there's a lack of optimism around right now, when you said that, I wanted to like scream like, oh my God, yes. Like, no, like, we don't talk about this even. And we don't, honestly, I don't watch the news anymore. I never watch news.
I have to professionally. Well, fortunately.
because of literally what you just said, because I'm so sick. Like, why can I never turn on the news and it can be breaking news? Khaled makes a cake. Like, why? Why can't I?
Something
like,
happy.
You know, it's always bad. It's always fear. There's always an agenda. And what I love about like this new field of podcasts is that this is now a new medium for a lot of people to get their news. Now I can pick the channels I want. I don't have to, you know, go, and I can get so many different perspectives more than I can in traditional media.
Yeah.
But not so on the optimism part, I 100% agree. And connections, yeah. There's a famous saying, I've said this on multiple podcasts and I'll say it again because it's a quote that really stuck with me. It's like, you measure the value of your life by the value of your relationships. Mm. And I'm like, that is the truest thing, and everything you talked about connection and stuff, that is, if you're more connected, you have amazing relationships with people, you're naturally going to be a happier person.
Of course.
You know, not perfect. I'm not saying perfect, but you're going to be more optimistic. That's guaranteed.
Right.
But Stephen, I wanted to say thank you so, so much for driving up here and coming on the show today. I knew from our 5-10 minute conversation a week ago, I'm like, I have to have Stephen on the podcast. Like, it's rare that I feel that connection, like immediate connection with a guest. I've learned so much. I literally walked into that. I literally knew nothing about research. I know how to Google, maybe, but I've learned so much from you. You've really opened my mind to so many different things that we went around the world in terms of topics. And I've really, really loved it. If people want to reach out to you, work with you, connect with you, what's the best way to get in touch?
Well, it's if people want to do that, I would be honored. And it's on, you know, probably LinkedIn these days.
Yeah. LinkedIn would be the best spot.
Yeah.
Great.
But you know, Khaled, let me say that you have achieved the almost impossible mission. you see what I'm doing? Almost impossible mission of making research sound interesting. Mm. I mean, you've opened my mind about some of the things that I do on a daily basis, but hadn't thought about in that way. So that's really, I think it's really hard to do, and that is definitely more of an art than a science.
Ah, come on. That doesn't get better than that. I'm not saying anything else, guys. You know where to find the podcast. Like, share, follow, subscribe at Hope It Helps Pod on Instagram and on all channels. Stephen, thank you so much again. And guys, as always, hope it helps. Peace.